Can you overprepare for a debate? Well, in one case, the candidate should have just thrown those briefing books into the river. It was the spirit of 76 in New York City Harbor, underneath the Statue of Liberty, the largest assemblage of ships in 150 years by some accounts. Over 200 vessels, including the tallest square-rigged sailing ships from all over the world. The ships had raced from the Canary Islands to Bermuda, and then proceeded, in company, to New York, led by the lead sailing ship of the United States, the Coast Guard Eagle. The stunning black and white Americo Vespucci of Italy, with its 26 square sails, staysails, and jibs, the 1,500 long ton Gorch Fock of Germany, the sleek little four masted Esmeralda of Chile, and even the Tsarina of the Sea, the hulky Krusenstern of the Soviet Union. There, in the harbor, they were met by an international naval review of warships from all over the world, coming together to create a spectacular sight, a celebration of the nation's bicentennial. Patriotic Americans crowded any area of New York or its suburbs where they could get a view. From the deck of the USS Forrestal, President Gerald Ford reviewed the parade of sail, complete with a 21-gun salute. It would be a busy day for the leader of the free world. He'd also go to Valley Forge and receive a giant silver cup as a gift of the city of brotherly love to the nation created in its city limits. It was a heady time. 200 years of America and lots of trinkets, belt buckles, flag ties, patches, ceramic mugs with stars and stripes and 76 blazing in order to celebrate it. In space, America's great presence was felt as the Viking 1 spacecraft landed on Mars and sent back photos. And on Earth, Farrah Fawcett posters became a major fad. And you went to the theater to watch Carrie, Network, The Bad News Bears, or see a Philadelphia underdog get a chance to take on the heavyweight champion of the world. And why not go to the theater? Gas is just 59 cents a gallon. If you flicked on your portable FM radio, you could hear Elton John and Kiki Dee sing Don't Go Breaking My Heart, or the Bee Gees sing You Should Be Dancing. You could hear any number of new disco hits, virtually static-free. Somewhere, in a California garage, two amateur electronics enthusiasts developed the Apple computer. Nobody thought too much about that yet. Meanwhile, in the political world, experimentation was going on as well, in both parties. On one hand, the Democratic challenger was barely known a few years before. He was a one-term governor of Georgia who said he'd never lie. 4 years earlier, he had tried to get the VP nomination of his party and got little support, too conservative for the party delegates. On the other hand, the Republican president, Gerald Ford, had been unelected. He received the presidential chair through the votes of Democrats in the House. The only Republican, Speaker Carl Albert told Nixon at the time, that the Democrats would vote for. Each candidate was not in line with the party establishment or party delegates. Ford, whose poll rating had dropped when he pardoned Nixon, picked Nelson Rockefeller as his vice president, and then drew a bruising primary campaign from California Governor Ronald Reagan. He barely won his nomination, with very little expectation now of victory. With Jimmy Carter 40 points ahead of Gerald Ford, he invoked the needs of the American people. The American people, Ford said, deserved, in his presidential opinion, the right to hear from their candidates. We'll never know what his recommendation would have been if he was 40 points up instead of down. But in any case, his call was great for television history. On accepting the nomination of the Republican Party in Kansas City, he said, "I am ready. I am eager to go before the American people and debate the real issues face to face with Jimmy Carter. The American people have a right to know firsthand exactly where both of us stand." What he did not call for was a debate between the man he had selected his running mate in Kansas City, Bob Dole, senator from Kansas, and the man that Jimmy Carter had selected, Senator Walter Mondale of Minnesota. But by putting the needs of the American people first, the American people deserved to hear, by elevating debates as a public good that the American people needed, he invited it. So the League of Women Voters, running the presidential debates at this point, particularly League Executive Director Peggy Lample, figured that three vice presidents had become presidents since 1945. Current president had been a vice president. The people should hear from the number twos as well. There doesn't seem to have been serious objection to a vice presidential debate at the negotiation sessions in 76 between the Ford and Carter campaigns. League officials seem to have felt that the Democrats were more favorable to the idea than the Republicans, but there was little real objection. Yet, Senator Bob Dole, as he campaigned, made it clear that he did not take the idea seriously. He said that the voters were more interested in going to a Friday night football game than in listening to the vice presidential candidate's debate. He frequently referred to the event as Doyle and Mundale debates. People don't even know our names. On the day of the debate, Dole said he would rather have the 4 or 5 days preparation time that he took to spend campaigning. But it turned out to be more of an important event than it would have seemed to Dole. Stakes were high, as the race at the top of the ticket between Carter and Ford was so close. Jimmy Carter had been stunned as President Ford was aggressive and sharp in their first debate. Then Ford had made a blunder in the second debate, saying there was no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. It didn't make sense, and it didn't look like Ford was connected with reality. Polls were tight, 48-42, Carter over Ford. So it went to the Veep candidates for the next possible turning point of this close campaign. So we look at the vice presidential choices that year, the one presidential-level decision made by a presidential candidate, Jimmy Carter. Sure, he had to think about geographic and party unity, but he had some choices. Mondale was picked with plenty of time. As a senator, he was a strong debater and speechmaker. President Gerald Ford had a vice president, Nelson Rockefeller, but in an attempt to stave off a conservative primary challenge, he had long ago agreed to drop him from the ticket. It didn't work. He still drew the Reagan challenge, and so to appease conservatives now at the convention, after he beat Reagan in the nomination contest, Ford picked Senator Bob Dole of Kansas, the former Republican National Committee chairman and enough of a conservative to make everyone happy. It was a compromise. We know Bob Dole today as a bit of a funny guy. He's a guy that's run for president several times. He's done some commercials. The Bob Dole of 1976, and you can go on YouTube and watch it, was a bit harsher in tone, and he was being sent out as Ford was staying in the White House and playing kind of a Rose Garden strategy where he wouldn't sink to Carter's level. Bob Dole was sent out to hit the campaign stump and attack the Carter-Mondale ticket. And that's who showed up at the debate October 15th, 1976. Walter Mondale and Bob Dole meet in Houston. He adopted that Veep candidate role of the hatchet man. Democrats like to talk about Watergate, he said, but they voted against it when we tried to extend the investigation to all corruption. If Democrats were investigated, there would be a hue and cry. Turning to his debating opponent, he then said, Mondale would drop dead. Although there was a slight joke to everything Dole was saying in this debate, he didn't give much evidence of a smile. Still, Dole established what has generally been the rule of a vice presidential debate since then. He attacked the top of the ticket more than the fellow at the bottom. I just wish Carter had a foreign policy, he said. Doesn't have any foreign experience. I don't know why he was interviewed in Playboy. I guess we'll give him the bunny vote. Good thing there are three debates. Carter's got three positions on every issue. But the best line, or so he thought, he held close to his chest. He was ready to use in defense. See, Dole knew that he'd get asked about Gerald Ford's pardon of Nixon, which was controversial in this election. Dole, as a senator running for re-election 2 years before, had criticized Ford for pardoning Nixon. So when asked about it, Dole retorted, I don't want any rub-off here. He brings up Watergate all the time. And then he said they didn't have anything to do with Watergate. The Nixon pardon didn't apply to him or Ford any more than these so-called Democrat wars, which he listed as World War II, the war in Korea, Vietnam, would apply to Carter and Mondale. But that wasn't enough. Then he said, you know, I did a calculation the other day. I figured up how many were killed in wars started by Democrats. 1.6 million Americans, enough to fill the city of Detroit. If you want to go back and rake that over and over, we can do that. That didn't go over so well in the debate. Many years later, he would tell PBS, in those days you had a stack of briefing books about too high. And that was in the briefing book, which I received from the Ford people, the National Committee, and I guess I should have exercised my own judgment. According to Mondale, when the moment happened in the TV debate, it was unbelievable. I had to try to keep a straight face because I think they blew the election right there. But did they? There were a lot more bends and turns in that 76 general election, so it would not be clear Carter and Mondale would win until the very election day. We've yet to see a Veep debate in history turn an election, but you can make a good case for that first year's vice presidential debate almost more than any of them. With such a tight race between Carter and Ford, and Carter's lead shrinking from that 40 points in the summer to 6, Mondale's performance helped stop the loss. In an election where everything mattered, It was an event at a crucial time that gave a boost to Carter Mondale. So Mondale was very anxious to get the chance to help out his running mate again in 1980, now that he was vice president. Though the presidential candidates didn't agree to a debate yet, Mondale personally sent a telegram to the League of Women Voters to try to get an event going at the vice presidential level. But the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party, George H.W. Bush, refused to yield, dubbing the vice presidential debates as strictly minor league, comparing the two candidates to minor league baseball players. "We're the Toledo Mudhens," he said. Dole's reaction and Bush's reaction to a VP debate not taking it very seriously shows that how, while these debates today are not perfect, while there are calls for less rules, more inclusion of third-party candidates, there has been an evolution. Today, it's now expected that a vice presidential nominee will debate, and so will a current vice president. But this experiment could have been zapped in 1980, and perhaps we would not be witnessing a debate between Vice President Joe Biden and his Republican challenger, Congressman Paul Ryan. Well, something happened after 1980, which the media and certainly the League of Women Voters couldn't ignore. Geraldine Ferraro, congresswoman from New York, was chosen as the Democrats' vice presidential candidate. Going into the debate, Vice President Bush would now face up with the first woman candidate on a major party national ticket. The Democrats certainly wanted to showcase her and negotiated a VP debate. In that debate, George H.W. Bush made the decision to treat her as any candidate and was aggressive right off the bat, attacking her liberal voting record, attacking her for having differences with her running mate Mondale, while he, as vice president, had absolute loyalty to Reagan. A key moment of the debate occurred when he differed on the covert ops and foreign policy and said, "But let me help you with the difference, Miss Ferraro, between Iran and the embassy in Lebanon." To start with, he should have said Congresswoman Ferraro. That led to her response. "I almost resent, Vice President Bush, your patronizing attitude that you have to teach me about foreign policy." Years later, Bush would tell Jim Lehrer, "I think she was ready. She probably had been rehearsed for that, and I can't even remember what it was. And I said, let me help you with it or something. And that brought the crowd to its feet. It's show business, Jim. It's not really debating." But for Ferraro's part, she claimed it was not planned at all. She said she didn't want to do that, didn't want to scold, just wanted to focus on me and not give any sort of negative impression to anybody who was watching. She saw the debate for her as Ferraro versus Ferraro, that she just had to do well and that show that a woman could hold her own on a national ticket. It does make VP debates interesting because now there have been two female candidates for the vice presidency, thus two participants in a national TV debate. I think it's safe to say that the 2008 debate with Sarah Palin and Joe Biden was not decisive in that election, certainly, and had much of the same quality. Instead of Ferraro versus Ferraro, it was Palin versus Palin. It was Palin trying to show that she deserved a place on the national ticket. Biden tried hard to steer clear of being seen as Vice President Bush was. I also believe that having suffered some criticism for her performance on interviews, Palin looked to the debate to improve her image, which meant avoiding direct attacks on Biden. The two candidates were conciliatory, "Can I call you Joe?" keeping their attacks on McCain and Obama, respectively, while they debated on energy reform. Darn right, those predatory lenders. Helped to give Palin a little boost, I believe, but wasn't decisive in the election. Sometimes debates between the vice presidential candidates matter, and sometimes they have not. But of all the TV debates in presidential elections, it's interesting that it's actually the vice presidential debates that have produced some of the most memorable moments. "Who am I and why am I here" is one of them. Third-party candidate Ross Perot had chosen Admiral James Stockdale as his running mate, and their ticket qualified for inclusion in the national debates. He joined the VP debate, and when Stockdale began with that line, "Who am I and why am I here," intended to show that he was not one of the major parties, was not a politician, the audience laughed, and it threw Stockdale off. At another moment, when announcer Hal Bruno asked about negative campaigning, Stockdale had misplaced his hearing aid and had to ask for the question to be repeated. Again, the audience laughed. It was funny, but it became difficult to see him as a potential vice president. The performance was so bad that it hurt Perot's numbers a bit, and a few campaign aides asked Perot to promise to drop Stockdale using the 25th if he was elected. Of course, Perot wouldn't do it. Stockdale later said in an interview that he was happy to join this vice presidential debating tradition just once, but it was stressful. he said. I was a fish out of water. It was as though everybody was picking on the man who had more practical real-life experiences than the whole batch of them put together. Russ Perot wouldn't get a chance to debate in 1996. He'd be excluded from the debates, and thus his new running mate, economics professor Pat Choi, did not get a chance to debate Al Gore and Jack Kemp. Too bad, because this made the debate a little less interesting. Al Gore began his 1996 debate against Republican Jack Kemp by offering a compromise. If you won't use any football stories, I won't tell any of my warm and humorous stories about chlorofluorocarbon abatement. I agree, Kemp said. I can't even pronounce that. The rest of the 90 minutes was so tepid between these two candidates that Veep debate veteran Bob Dole joked it looked like a fraternity picnic. But we haven't discussed the most important moment of vice presidential debating, the one which everyone knows, which will probably hold the title for some time, the debate of 1988 between Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas and Dan Quayle of Indiana. It's well documented, and I almost do need to tell you the moment, and of course it involved Benson telling Quayle, I knew Jack Kennedy, I served with Jack Kennedy. Senator, you are no Jack Kennedy. Of course, the elder senator was playing on a double entendre that the audience picked up on, but he could ostensibly claim not to be participating in. He was just saying, you don't support the policies that Jack Kennedy did. But of course, what he really meant to say to the TV audience was that Quayle was not the type of man, person, or politician that the iconic former president was, that he didn't deserve to be on the national stage. So when Quayle reacted to that and said, Senator, that was uncalled for. Lloyd Benson just responded, You are the one making the comparison. Folks, the old guy beats outraged newbie anytime. Benson became, of the entire 1988 election, the most beloved, the highest poll ratings of all four people running. But he wasn't on the top of the ticket. Now, I will engage in a little bit of a defense of Dan Quayle here on this point. Obviously not a great TV moment, but Dan Quayle's statement was made about the Jack Kennedy when he was under attack for his perceived lack of experience. Serious Republicans like Al Haig said, you know, your pick was the dumbest move George Bush could have made. So in answering the question during the debate, Dan Quayle said the question goes to whether I'm qualified. I have more experience in Congress than Jack Kennedy did when he ran for president. So here was Quayle running for vice president. A little bit of defense of Dan Quayle there. It wasn't an attempt to claim that he was a Kennedy. It was a response to an attack. He entered the House in 1977. Okay. Then he did 4 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate, 12 years total. Kennedy entered the House in 1946, 4 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate. Same experience as Kennedy. So Kennedy is a hero that's so adored, though, it's not difficult to see how in a well-prepared debate rehearsal that line could have been readied. Judy Woodruff, one of the moderators in that room, said that as much as they tried, there was no way they could calm the audience after that comment. Yet the greatest vice presidential debate win ever, that in 1988, didn't help the ticket at all. People voted for the top of the ticket, and Dukakis Benson lost the election. There was a result potentially derived from that debate, and that would lead aides of George H.W. Bush to consider dropping Quayle. It was urged by former President Ford and urged by the president's son, George W. Bush. So if you score big like Benson did and you still can't win the election, does that mean these Veep debates are a waste of time? Well, this is an interesting question. Let's look at the league's contention back in 76 now that we have some hindsight. The point was that we need these debates because there had been three vice presidents who had become president since 1945. Well, we've now had another 30 years, and fortunately no VP has had to become president. So we didn't need it for that reason. But I think it's worked in this way. It has added to the exposure of the vice president and the power of that office. It is no longer, as it was in Truman's time, a non-entity who could be, you know, a name at the bottom of the ticket and make some boss happy to swing the nomination. The whole nation's going to see now who you pick as your running mate on national TV in this moment. And I think it's always a consideration now in VP picks. Can they get through the debate? I guarantee you it came up in Romney's mind in picking Ryan, someone who had been a member of a House and obviously participated in a number of debates. The first VP to debate, let us not forget, Walter Mondale, was also the first to move into the White House with an office adjacent to the president. Zig Brzezinski, Carter's NSC director, noted how Mondale's location in the White House office ensured that he'd be a relevant part of decisions. Also, Carter made a decision right off the bat, an executive order, that put Mondale second in charge of the control of nuclear weapons in the country. It had been, due to a federal statute in 1958, the Secretary of State who would be the second in command in terms of nuclear weapons. Yet vice presidential candidates always assume the first role of spokesperson for the ticket. And generally, the vice presidential debates have been about the top ticket candidates and their qualifications and less about the bottom ticket candidates. So maybe in thinking that we were going to get to learn more about the VP candidates by these debates, the league erred. We'll see coming up in the debate between Ryan and Biden if this changes. I also wonder if sometimes we think the vice presidential debates don't matter because the strategy of one side or the other was played so well that it made it so in that election. I'm thinking about 2004. Cheney was never a political figure. He's not known as a good debater. He was going to face John Edwards, charismatic, known to be a successful trial lawyer. So in negotiations, they made sure to get John Edwards sitting in a chair on a table along with Cheney, rather than to have those two podiums where Edwards could be more animated. It would still get nasty. There was debates about Cheney's tenure at Halliburton and Edwards' attendance record in the Senate. Cheney made no effort to conceal that he was a lot more important than Edwards. "Frankly, you have a record in the Senate that's not very distinguished," he said. "First time I ever met you was when we walked in the stage tonight," which was later pointed out not to be true. It was the third time they had met and there was a photo. But it was all smart strategy because Cheney didn't need a win as so much to throw off Edwards and to avoid a loss in that debate. But did that mean that the vice presidential debate didn't matter in 2004? No, it was probably a big worry for the Bush-Cheney 2004 ticket, and it was something to be prepared for. And anytime you're preparing for one thing in a campaign, it's time you're not focusing on something else. So I do think they play an important role. Thus, we now head into another vice presidential debate, October 11th. And just like 1976, it's going to be somewhat interesting because you have a very close election here and you had a very poor mile-high debate performance by President Obama. Romney came out looking sharper, clearer, more aggressive, you know, making the point of his message. "You've had 4 years now," direct to the president. Now the momentum has swung a bit to the Republican side. This type of presidential performance is not new at all. You know, I was looking at it after the debate. There must be some kind of a disdain for briefing books, debate rehearsal, you know, throwing the campaign guys out of the Oval at work with incumbent presidents, because quite often, I'm thinking 1980, 1984, 1992, 2004, an incumbent president is judged to have lost their first debate against a challenger who prepared better. That appears to have happened here now in the 2012 election. History repeats itself once again. Didn't happen to Clinton, didn't happen to Ford for different reasons. Clinton was a great debater. Versus Dole, Ford had really prepared. He didn't take it lightly at all. So now the VP debate will play the role as the next event of the campaign, right? And the next time for either Republicans to build on a little momentum here or for Biden to recover for the team. I do note it's an interesting challenge. You know, Biden was elected to the Senate 2 years after Ryan was born. So you have this contrast of young old. Okay, that didn't work out so well for Benson Quayle. Doesn't mean it'll have the same result here. Biden's a skilled debater in the Senate. And there's a lot of talk, however, about how he makes these common gaffes, which from time to time he does. I would note that a lot of the gaffes that get reported with Biden occur when he's speaking to a big rally. He's very enthusiastic, makes a comment that probably plays well with the crowd, but then gets reported on the 6 o'clock news and doesn't sound so well. He's participated in a lot of debates. He had a decent convention speech this year. At the same time, Ryan's had some experience in the House speaking in debates, his knowledge of policy, and will be able to talk numbers up and down. So we'll see how it goes. But as you watch this debate, you'll have a little bit of the history as to why the debaters are debating and what the role has been in the past. I'll leave you with one question. Will there ever be a time when there will be two vice presidential debates, further increasing the role of the vice president in a election campaign? We'll see. Maybe at some point when there are more presidential debates, that will occur. I want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. There I have a link for the archive. Right now, $14.99. Now, the price is going to move up soon. We're going to be selling the best of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. It'll be the 20 most popular podcasts. And that will be available on iTunes. It'll be available on Amazon, other places where you can buy music. They'll be available as an album, and it will be available as individual podcasts. So we'll be doing that, and then the price of the entire archive will move up. What's the justification? Well, you know, we've been doing this for 6 years now. There's a lot more episodes than there used to be. In the meantime, if you like the program, please tell someone about it. I'm happy to see all the blog posts mentioning My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, helps other people to know about the program. And thanks for listening.